Mother Earth is psychedelic. Her body is covered with psychoactive, sacred medicine. Can psychedelics help us become more conscious and loving parents, partners, lovers, and leaders? Welcome to the Psychedelic Mom Podcast. I'm your host, Michaela Carlin, the Psychedelic Mom, a mother and entrepreneur partnering with Mother Earth's sacred plant medicines to heal, awaken, and learn to live in alignment to my truth. Psychedelic literally means soul revealing. What reveals the soul to oneself is psychedelic. I invite you to join me in deep conversations with leaders, healers, seekers, and other parents. I will share my journey, the wisdom, practices, medicines, and mistakes that have changed my life, and personal stories of others on this wild path. We are the medicine needed to birth the more beautiful world we know is possible. Welcome, Jim, to the Psychedelic Mom Podcast. I am so excited to have you here, and I'm really grateful that you took this time today to be with us to tell us your story.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for the welcome.
You know, when I kind of did a little research about your life, you have one of those lives that people look at and it's like, that's the life that I aspire to. A adventurer who climbs to the top highest of mountains, who became a National Geographic photographer. And it seems to me you found your own path. It wasn't a path that just was kind of a traditional route, that you were a renegade in your own way of always following this deep path, and then had this life-changing accident that occurred, and then have been on a process and of recovery that was just as miraculous as the path that you were already on. So I'm curious about the beginning of your life and how you got to this place of being this adventurer and photographer in the world.
Some of kind of the early life aspects that influenced and steered me that way were, I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is not a very outdoorsy place. It's such a, athletics are so team sport oriented there. But my dad did triathlons when I was a little kid. So I think that was already a little bit like having an individual sport was a little bit unusual. Having like a parent that participated in athletics was a little bit unusual, at least in the 80s when I was growing up, where it was mostly spectating, like people participated in sports maybe through college. And then in adulthood, like sports weren't for adventure or growth. It was really just for like exercise and jogging and things like that. So to have a parent who was somewhat competitive and competed regularly in these races was like, triathlons were pretty fringe back in the 80s.
Interesting. Yeah, your dad was a renegade. I'm thinking back then of thinking of someone who was, that would have been considered an extremist. They would have been like, why is he doing that?
Like, I didn't have other extended family members who were doing anything similar. Or another big piece of that was my mom's a school teacher. So she always encouraged my brother and I to kind of like follow our own path, march to the beat of our own drummer a bit. And one of the ways that came about was that she taught in public schools and was skeptical enough about the schools that she taught in that they sent us to this private Montessori school. And so much of the Montessori philosophy is about empowering kids from a really young age to spend time on the things they're interested in and to make space for kids to be self-determined in their interests. And it's really interesting looking back at the kids who came out of that program, kids, you know, who I was in grade school with, and the really wide diversity of careers. Probably the most accomplished of my like grade school peers is a Biden advisor and has been involved in politics at a national level since I think early 20s. Somebody else is an English professor. Somebody else has been shooting softcore pinup girls for the last like 20 years, like has made a career of like what I imagine is a kind of a niche.
That's amazing. Like that foundation just right there. Having a father that was disciplined and like really excited about his path, a mom that was already engaging you in that self-determination and probably a deep listening of who you are and what you're passionate about and follow that. What a gift.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think I was set up, I was pointed this way maybe from an early age.
And then how did you, was your family into camping and did they bring you on these amazing trips?
No, I was the one who was interested in that, and I got them into it. When I was 15, I saved up a couple thousand dollars from 2 summers of mowing lawns and went on a Knowles trip, which is the National Outdoor Leadership School, and went on this month-long backpacking trip in Idaho. And that was a real inflection point of an experience for me, where I came back from that with a sense of kind of personal empowerment that I didn't have growing up, and I felt like I fit in that setting, backpacking with like a group of peers, that in a way that I never quite felt like I fit in with peers quite so easily in the Midwest.
When you look back at even like the Knowles program and the Montessori, and you think of that time, like even being out in the wilderness, learning first to find what you love and then finding this wilderness program, what do you feel like nature ended up teaching you at that time, back at that age?
There's something that's like hard to put my finger on about just being in really big, wide open spaces, like feeling really small, but also really empowered to go, like there's a lot of opportunity to go where you want and do what you want. But at the same time, it's very humbling. You're small and fragile in a big and wild world. And I think one of the things that's so powerful for adolescents doing wilderness trips is there's a part in our development where it's really difficult to connect our actions and the consequences sometimes, right? Like teens are notorious for having poor judgment around some of those things. And nature is so good at providing really immediate consequences, where if you don't put on your rain jacket and it starts raining, like you're going to be wet. And that's maybe not the end of the world, but there's like this really tangible, immediate consequence where so many of the consequences from day to day life in society, we're really insulated from. It's like, oh, if you're not putting money into your retirement account now, that's gonna have some negative outcomes in 30 years. But that's those kind of things are really abstract, I think, when you're an adolescent. There's so many really tangible lessons from like what you do or don't do in the course of a day that are easy to transfer back into like socialized life.
That's so true. It's like immediate response, like didn't pack my bag in a balanced way, and now my hike is harder.
Yeah, or I put my lunch at the bottom of the backpack, and now I have to unpack everything to get to this thing that I want. Or like dealing with blisters and untied shoes and things. You're like, I can not deal with this, and it will be worse, or I can stop right now and take care of it, and it will maybe be like some degrees better.
So, how did you transition into photography? Was this something that you were always really interested in? Or was that something that when you were out in nature, it inspired you?
Yeah, it was something I was really interested in. Like my dad had done 2 tours in Vietnam and had brought back a what was it, Nikkor mat, like whatever Nikon was before it became rebranded as Nikon. Brought back this like 1970s heavy metal film camera. So we had a bunch of like Time Life books on photography, like a series that I remember reading, and got into film photography maybe somewhere in like grade school and high school, and did that a bit. Like really enjoyed it, but I didn't really get very good at it until digital cameras became a thing. And I bought a digital camera in college and started shooting like lots of ski and bike photos of friends when I was out in university in Missoula. And then so that was kind of a hobby for a handful of years, and that coincided with the rise of digital photography, and then also like the rise of social media. Like taking photos of ski trips and posting them on message boards and the internet, where other like-minded ski enthusiasts would give me like validation and like a motivation to like it was a way to connect with people, I think mostly.
Were you doing extreme things athletically?
In 2009, a couple friends and I went on this big backpacking trip in Alaska, and no part of it felt all that extreme. But I think cumulatively, it was this month-long trip through a really remote area in Alaska, and came home and put together this trip report, like a photo essay, really, like a bunch of captioned photos, maybe like 100 or 150 photos, kind of all in a chronological series, and and posted it on a ski message board, that wasn't really very heavily trafficked in the summertime when we'd gone on this trip. First, it got really popular on this message board, and then it was maybe the very early days of Reddit, and people started reposting it to Reddit. So I think that trip report made it to the front page of Reddit a few times.
That's amazing. And what was it that was so captivating?
That's a really good question. It's something I've thought a lot about. I think there was something somewhat fuzzy to me answer of like people really gravitate to its authenticity of some guys who aren't professionals, aren't being paid to do this, are like take some time off and go on this big adventurous trip with some uncertain outcomes. And I think there was like just like it really seemed like it hit a cultural nerve for people. And that really, you know, almost on its own launched a photo career where I got invited on a trip with pro skiers shortly after that and got invited to help shoot a ski movie around that same time. And so kind of had these other doors that began opening, even though I had no professional camera training or background.
I mean, do most people say to you, you have the life that I dream of?
I've heard that before, yeah.
I think so many people would say, including myself, a National Geographic photographer. And it sounds like what's so amazing is it wasn't really planned. What you just said, you were at this time of life when suddenly you post this and it happens to go viral. And that was, a real sliding door moment in your life. It sounds like that really changed the trajectory of your life.
It did, yeah, absolutely.
And so after that initial kind of feedback of, whoa, people like my stuff and they like the authentic aspects of what I'm putting out there, where did that lead?
That led to doing like doing magazine stories. Like the fun stuff were things where I would get to like write a story or I would get to pitch an idea. And then like a ski magazine would say, yes, we will. Here's some money to go do this thing that you think is interesting. And trying to find out ways to monetize that, which is like the publishing industry is really, print has changed a lot in the last decade since I was really involved in that. And even 10 years ago, there wasn't a ton of money involved. So it was really scrappy. And so there was more money in doing corporate adventure photography, like marketing driven things. So that was like shooting catalog photos. And a big door opening for me was kind of doing some of these small time photo gigs, but not really enough to make it. And in the meantime, having waiting tables at night and teaching avalanche courses on the weekends and tuning skis and doing like five jobs to stay afloat in a mountain town, then was invited to go to do, like help with an Eddie Bauer photo shoot. So they hired me at a day rate for, I think maybe like 7 days. And all of a sudden had like the biggest check that I'd ever received in my life. And it was like, I just made more in a week than I had in like 3 months. And I was like, well, at the very least, I'm not going to go back to waiting tables. And maybe I can just, if I could do 3 or 4 jobs like this a year, I'll be making as much as I was doing a whole series of other jobs. And so then I just kind of threw myself at like photo and video work. And I think the real downside that keeps it from being as enviable as it seems on the surface is like how scrappy and frugal the financial aspect of it is. And just before we jumped on this interview, you had mentioned that like I had avoided a big expensive college in favor of a inexpensive, you know, state school. And yeah, so I got good enough grades to be granted admission into some expensive schools, which is what I thought I wanted until I really had to kind of face the music of what sort of loans I was going to take out. And then at that point, I really took a big veering turn and ended up at school in Missoula, Montana instead. Like if I had graduated with $200,000 in college debt, there's no way I would have ever been able to pursue that. Like none of that would have been feasible.
It's pretty interesting, actually, when you think about it, because earlier you were talking about how nature has this instant kind of result. If you don't pack the bag well, or you don't bring a raincoat, you get wet. And you mentioned how if you don't put money away for, you know, for your retirement, it's not an instant thing. But it sounds like even as a younger person, you were thinking out in the distance and saying, I don't want to buy into the system where I'm going to go to this college and then spend years paying that back. Like,
That's kind of interesting. Like, did you have those kinds of conversations, or was it just a moment that that occurred to you?
I think in hindsight, it feels more like it came out of some emotions of like overwhelm and avoidance versus like at the time, I thought maybe I want to go be a park ranger. And I was like, maybe I don't need an Ivy League education if I want to go work at a national park.
And did you see other friends taking that path?
No, there was, I went to like a college prep high school where definitely the ethos was to get into the most prestigious and most expensive school you could and to pursue that at pretty much all costs.
And there is a cost. So now you are doing these three jobs, making more than what you had done. But as you said, it's not all glamorous out there in the world of National Geographic or photographer. What are some of the other kind of aspects of it that people don't realize that are really challenging?
I think there's an aspect you can see so much of now in our current social media atmosphere, which is this idea of audience capture, where if you get good at something, then the demand is to do more of that. It can be stifling to creativity and stifling to authenticity. And we see a ton of that in the influencer world, right? Because I may feel so sorry for people who, because they were born really pretty, are able to get a lot of attention when they post a selfie. And so then there's this cycle of
feedback loop
being validated for that. Yeah. And so like, well, but then maybe they really have some other thing that they're actually really passionate about, but then they try and share that to the internet and it doesn't get the same likes, validation, feedback. And so they just go back to like, to being pretty or to being, you can see it really in like pop music, where it's so interesting when there's musicians who have big hits who are then able to like go and do something else and continue to reinvent themselves versus just trying to like make the same album again and again.
So what would you say is the most extreme thing that you did when it came to your athleticism and adventures?
From my perspective, it didn't really feel that extreme. Just like going down any sort of rabbit hole, as you get more and more specialized in an area, like you're ideally always, you know, kind of operating at the periphery of your comfort zone, but not so many steps outside of it that it gets catastrophic. And I think that's the case for skiing and backpacking, where, you know, maybe go on a 3-day trip and that 3-day trip goes pretty well. And then you go on a 5-day trip and that goes pretty well. And then you end up going a week trip and then you go to a different state to go on a week long trip. And it kind of like slowly escalates in the same way, you know, all kinds of professional degree programs are designed to coach people into different degrees of specialization. And so over, you know, a decade or a dozen years of traveling, like 4 and 6 months out of the year, I feel like I gained a pretty robust skill set for navigating like mountain environments that somebody who hasn't done that would say it's really extreme, but it's maybe like a little bit analogous to like me operating, being in a surgical theater and being the one holding the scalpel versus a surgeon holding the scalpel. Like for me, that would be really extreme. For somebody who's spent years and years of their life being practiced at that, maybe that incision isn't such a big deal. So from that perspective, it felt like the things that I was doing were pretty grounded in something realistic and doable. From an outside perspective, from my family in the Midwest, it certainly looked pretty adrenaline chasing.
When I say extreme, I just mean like, don't they categorize it as like an extreme sport?
I did a lot of like endurance, more endurancey things than like jumping off of cliffs. Like a lot of like long, one of the National Geographic trips was I skied across northern Mongolia with wolverine researchers, which was like mostly flat and very cold and very wild and very remote. But like there wasn't like cliffs and parachutes and death defying. It was more just like uncomfortable and remote and logistically weird.
So one of the things that made me reach out to you actually to have you on my show as the psychedelic mom is my daughter said to me, did you read that article about the photographer that had an accident and then was at a concert and took magic mushrooms and had a profound altering physical experience? So I wanted to see if we could pivot a little bit here and talk about where you were first, like leading up to that moment that I was reading on your Instagram, like I said, that I think you're coming upon an anniversary of sorts. And I would love to go down that path with you and talk about that part of your life.
Yeah, it is an auspicious anniversary. So 8 years ago today, I was somewhere in transit between Chile and Patagonia, where I was hurt, and North America, where I had my fractured spinal cord decompressed and five of those vertebrae fused. So the trip that was leading up to that was a friend and I had come up with an idea to ski the length of the ice cap in Patagonia, in southern Argentina and Chile. And so we'd spent about a year and a half planning, preparing for this trip. And then I broke 9 vertebrae almost at the outset. Like, I'd only been there a few days, hadn't even really begun the trip yet. And we're just practicing in a field with these snow kites that are there's a sport called kite surfing where people get pulled around over bodies of water on
I love kite surfing.
Yeah. Okay. So there's sister sport, sibling sport is snow kiting. That's almost a very similar kite. And same idea that you can use a kite like a sail, like a sailboat might use a sail to be pulled around. Some people get really good at it and do like tricks off of waves in bodies of water or off of like little rolly hills in the mountains. But generally it's a sport for like flat open areas versus like steep mountainous ones. In our case, we wanted to use them to like pull us horizontally across these hundreds of miles of flat glaciers.
Sounds like so much fun. Honestly, it sounds like a blast.
Yeah, they're really cool and interesting. Also, things went really wrong for me, where I got picked up and slammed down by a large gust of wind, by a powerful wind gust. When I regained consciousness, I realized I was paralyzed. I couldn't feel or move anything from the chest down.
How many people were you with at this point?
I was with one friend who was there, but I don't think he really witnessed the impact.
When you were falling down, was it so fast that you didn't realize what were happening? Or when that wind took you, were you like, oh God, this isn't going to be good?
The last thing I remember was just being a couple feet off the ground and not being panicked about that. The kite was depowered. You can control the lines on the kite, almost like a puppet marionette. So the kite was in its kind of lowest power setting. There was an emergency cord that I could have pulled that would have just cut the kite loose and I would have just fallen a few feet to the ground. But the last moment I remember, it wasn't quite panicked emergency. It was it was intense and it was a little bit concerning. Like, I'd certainly been caught off, like the winds had been fairly light, and then a really big gust came up that was a bit anomalous, but also Patagonia is known for being incredibly windy.
And so then how long were you unconscious?
Like maybe a few minutes, like enough for there to be maybe some sort of brain trauma there along with the spine trauma, but I was never diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury.
So then when you did come to, did you have this feeling like this isn't good? Or were you kind of not aware of how badly you had been injured?
I was pretty aware, self-diagnosed, that I was concussed and paralyzed. But I didn't know much about spinal cord injuries. And I spent a couple of days in a Chilean hospital without any kind of prognosis. And so somewhere in there pretty early on had sort of made up my mind that I was going to have a recovery. But that was like out of an absence of information rather than any really informed opinion or any doctor's opinion.
Was there kind of a combination of determination and terror? Or were you just so with the life that you had lived? Was it just like, oh, here's another obstacle that I will get over?
I've been involved in a few different emergency situations, and only one where I've been the patient, but I've been first on the scene for other people's accidents. I think my kind of neurological response, psychological response in that moment is very action-oriented. Like, it doesn't tend to be a very emotional time. Like, it's, and then later kind of in the aftermath, once the immediacy of the situation has passed, then I feel like all the emotions come flooding in for me. So in those kind of initial early days of being paralyzed, there was like a real sense of purpose and mission around getting myself back to North America. And that certainly wasn't just something that I did. The companions I was with really helped. My brother and parents were working back from the United States side to help facilitate an evacuation back to the United States. So it was a team effort. And also that was like where all my focus was going versus like pondering the what ifs and like the existential terror of what life might look like in the future.
Did that ever come?
I chipped the spinous process in one of my neck vertebrae. And that really concerned me at the time of my accident. So I was like, okay, I'm paralyzed from chest down, but I can still use my hands. It turned out that that fracture really wasn't something that endangered my spinal cord, but I didn't know that. And I think maybe the doctors didn't realize that at first. And so I was really concerned about what it might be like to be a quadriplegic. I was like, if I'm a paraplegic already, like really don't want this to be exacerbated any further with like a neck spinal cord injury somehow in the transport between continents. But then to like circle back to your question, well, I think I pushed off some of the terror for a ways in my recovery, where it really took about 2 years before that felt like it all caught up with me. Like, I feel like I had this kind of immediate reaction of needing to take care of myself and to get myself to definitive medical care. And then once that crisis had kind of passed, within a few weeks after spine fusion, I began to like, first I could wiggle a toe and then began to flex my quad muscles on one leg just a bit. And so then I kind of transferred a lot of sense of purpose to this idea of being like recovery guy and putting everything, all the attention and focus I could into that. And so it wasn't like there weren't some really bad days or a fair amount of despondency or isolation in that. But I think overall, I kind of had a pretty balanced and optimistic outlook for the first year and a half or so.
Unbelievable, really. Even that kind of mindset, do you think some of that came from your experiences out in nature? And it's a pretty profound way to be, to take that approach of like, what's the next step? How can I, you know, I wiggled a toe. How can I tomorrow wiggle two toes?
I do think the outdoors and the life experience that I had up to that point really informed that. Like, I think one of the skills is being able to take a really large problem and parse it down into individual chunks. Doing that in the face of huge uncertainty is really hard for humans. Like, we're just, and I'd had more life practice with that, where there's a lot of that in the outdoors, where it's like, if you're really anxious about whether it might rain next week, you're probably not going to enjoy backpacking. Like, there's some level of like, I don't know what that weather's going to bring, and I have to let go of that, and I'll deal with it when I get there. And I had a lot of like very concrete, tangible experience with that. But I don't think most of us deal with, I don't think most humans deal with facing that sort of uncertainty in tangible ways, day in and day out. And I think spine injury certainly felt like a lot of that. And so a lot of people who are freshly paralyzed are told by doctors that they won't walk again. Like, it's a really common thing, unfortunately, that doctors say. I say unfortunately because there isn't right now a way to image someone's spine trauma in a way that can really give a very meaningful prognosis. It's really hard to gauge what sort of recovery someone might have. We just don't have the imaging tools to do that at this point. But doctors still give kind of this worst case prognosis. And I think maybe one of the pressures the doctors face is this emotional side for patients of people really wanting a definitive answer. And the doctors saying like, well, the only thing we can definitively say is that chances are giving a kind of a worst case outcome braces people to avoid disappointment, but it sort of soothes this need for certainty in a really uncertain situation.
Were you told that?
I was not. No, my doctor never told me I wouldn't walk again. I think it was inferred in various ways, where one of the best predictors of recovery from brain trauma or spine trauma is how quickly a patient is decompressed, how quickly blood flow is restored to that tissue where there's been this compression. And then when brain tissue or spine tissue is bruised, it just like any bruise, there's a swelling that happens there. And when it's inside a skull or inside a spinal column, there's nowhere for that swelling to go. And so that swelling just causes pressure to increase. And as pressure increases, blood flow stops happening. As the blood flow stops happening, the tissue stops getting oxygen. And so those bony structures are meant to protect that really fragile tissue from impact. But then when they're not enough to protect it, they really can kind of be a hindrance. And so the treatment for a lot of severe traumatic brain injuries or spinal cord injuries is to go and physically remove the bone so that tissue has room to expand. And then as swelling goes down, with TBI patients, they will like take a piece of someone's skull off of their head and then later replace it. And when that happens pretty quickly, the outcomes can be pretty good. The longer the time span between the injury and the decompression, the less likelihood there is that tissue will be able to recover. Like it's just been without oxygen for too long.
And so where were you in that time frame?
I was like at 8 days. Beyond 24 hours in Western medicine, my understanding is there's not really much cause for hope. That ideally, like people are rushed into surgery within a few hours. And if you're in surgery within 3 hours, it might make a big difference in what that person's presentation is, you know, a year later versus somebody who is 6 hours or 9 hours or 12 hours to surgery. Beyond 24 hours, there stops really being much urgency after about a day. And that's because the doctors don't think there would probably be much possibility that tissue will ever be able to recover. So the fact that my body began healing after some weeks is pretty unusual on its own.
Do you think any of that had to do with mindset?
I mean, it's tempting to say yes, but like the most truthful answer is I really don't know.
What would you say that going through something so life-altering has taught you?
That's a good question. I don't have like a tidy answer. I think it's probably changed me in some pretty foundational ways, like the way I relate to my own body as one. Through spinal cord injury and also through psychedelics, I really experienced myself as being a team effort, of being like a lot of parts all working in coordination, where kind of my normal default setting prior to that was perceiving myself as like the dialogue in my head as the captain of this, you know, meat suit.
So let's talk about the psychedelic part of this. Where were you in your recovery process and how did it come to be that you ended up taking a psychedelic?
I was in hospitals from December through April and then was an outpatient from April through June and then had moved to Northern California to go do physical therapy with a nonprofit called High Fives Foundation that's based there. And so I went and lived in a friend's basement and went and did, you know, free to me physical therapy every day with High Fives. But through that time, it was now like 9 months after spinal cord injury. And really my entire life had been, you know, been like months in hospitals and then a few months out of hospitals, but still really focused on rehab. And there just hadn't been much of a social or fun aspect to my life. It all felt pretty serious and it was just such a grind.
Mm.
And then a physical therapist who I'd worked with in the hospital for months came out from Northern California for a music festival with her friends and invited me to join. So I went to this 4-day music fest, which in one way was just so great to be out kind of like in public. And in another side, I felt so conspicuous and out of place. I was really self-conscious about my walker and walking poles that I would use, like arm crutches. Yeah, so in some ways, I felt really a part of the scene. In some part, I felt kind of like this outsider. I felt really self-conscious about the medical device situation. And I also felt really self-conscious about the sort of level of partying that was happening around me. One thing that I'd found was that even really small amounts of alcohol really negatively affected the very mediocre walking ability that I'd regained. That even before feeling anything like an alcohol buzz, that my legs would stop working and I'd collapse and I'd be unable to walk.
So there you are at this festival.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a really
kind of the first time to get out.
Right.
And you're probably looking around like these people are having fun and partying maybe more than I even want to, even if I wasn't in this situation.
The level of partying there was fairly high. There was a lot of inebriation, a lot of cannabis, a lot of alcohol, I'm sure other substances. It was a real, there was a strong showing from like the hippie community, like the Rainbow Family was there, like a, I don't know what, 800 or 1,000 people who are full-time kind of transient hippies. So it was a really interesting scene to be a part of. And also I felt like some sense of FOMO and some sense of like just being an outsider, even now that I was kind of rejoining public life. And so somewhere in there, like on day 3 of 4-day concert, I had part of someone's mushroom chocolate. Somebody offered it me. I think I ate about half. I'm not sure how much psilocybin it contained.
Had you had mushrooms before in your life?
I had. Maybe always, and never in a ceremonial context, just always in a celebratory context, like, you know, going out and camping and exploring desert canyons with friends and things that were like social and also kind of nature-based and really kind of turning the dial up on that awe and wonder of the natural world and just kind of the joy and glee of scrambling around. And so that was the context I'd experienced it in before. And doing it in a like a heavily populated concert setting was a bit of a new thing for me. That wasn't something I'd really partaken in before.
And so in some ways, there's this saying in the kind of psychedelic world, sometimes this differentiation between whether someone is partaking in a plant medicine or a psychedelic for the work or therapeutic usage or recreational, right? And a lot of people in the field talk about, well, recreational really comes from the word recreational. And in some ways, it sounds like you had in your own way kind of a recreational moment that night. So can you tell us a little bit about what the experience was with the mushroom, what you saw, what you sensed in your body, and what shifts took place?
Yeah, so I had this, you know, moderate mushroom dose, intending a fully, you know, celebratory recreational experience of wanting more connection and kinship and like more appreciation of this music and environment. And instead, what happened is I discovered that muscles in my leg that hadn't worked up until that point, suddenly I had like voluntary control over. At the time, that was really unusual, but maybe not. I think it was like almost more like the day after, like a day afterwards, where it really was like, actually, that was bizarre. Like these muscles that I've been spending like certainly tens of hours in therapy trying to get like my hamstring on one leg just wouldn't fire at all. And so that meant that I could walk, but I had to drag one foot around. And all of a sudden, I could pick that foot up off the ground for the first time in 9 months.
Now, did that happen at the festival? Did you suddenly kind of like pick your leg up? And
yeah, exactly. Like all of a sudden was just being at the festival and standing was, it's like a athletic endurance event for me, right? And someone in our group had a knee scooter. She had a cast on her leg and had like this, like a little padded scooter that her knee was propped on where she could not have to bear weight on that leg. But she was kind of on and off the scooter, and I was using it to like sit on or kneel on or to like take weight off of one leg at a time. But other than that, it was like, you know, endurance standing in a field for hours at a time that was really taxing for me at the time. And somewhere in there, realized that I could pull my heel up towards my butt where I hadn't, like it just wasn't a movement that I'd been able to do at all. And suddenly I could do that, not just get that muscle to fire, but have it be strong enough to work against gravity.
What was that moment like? Were you like, well, I think I might be high. This might not be true. I might be hallucinating that my leg is moving up. Or did you
it
have...
It was pretty clear. Like I wasn't that altered. I was still like pretty grounded in, you know, consensus reality. Things were just a little more like swirly and twinkly. So that seemed exciting, but it wasn't, I guess, in that moment. It seemed like it just could be a coincidence. And there was also just a lot of stimulation. There was music and people. And we had some conversations about it at the time with my physical therapist and with my, you know, girlfriend at the time who was there. Like it was a topic of conversation, but I don't think anyone was as interested in it as the interest that has led to this conversation now, right?
Right. Yeah.
Like it was more like, oh, that's great. Congratulations. Like I think my physical therapist was like, oh, did that start working, you know, sometime this summer since we last seen each other? I was like, no, like it happened like right now. Like 3 minutes ago was when it started working.
Wow. Did you have this sense of joy? Like, well, this is good. This is going to be really good.
I don't think I did, to be honest. And maybe, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, like it wasn't, I don't think that psilocybin acted as like a magic bullet for me in that instance. Like it did, on one hand, I think there's some really interesting phenomena with people with traumatic nerve injuries, especially with their first psychedelic experience, that not everyone but some significant number of people have experienced some sort of immediate neural return after a traumatic nerve injury and during the first psychedelic experience. Like, I've heard quite a few other stories from other people since this article was published, and really even in the years prior, you know, since this happened 7 years ago. It's been an area of interest of mine. And yeah, there's quite a few stories. And
so before this accident, were you curious about how psychedelic might help in this way?
Before spinal cord injury? No, I don't think I didn't have any awareness of the healing properties of psychedelics or the neurogenic properties of psychedelics. And it wasn't until, so I had this experience where some leg muscles start working and kind of was curious about that afternoon, and then more curious about it and the aftermath of that, as it kept working the next day and the day after, and it seemed like some sort of neurological pathway had been restored, and that led to conversations with neurodocs and me disclosing this drug use, which felt like in 2015, the atmosphere around this topic was a lot different than it is now. There's a lot less enthusiasm.
You couldn't really talk about it.
Yeah, there wasn't the only place it's being covered in the media is maybe like Vice News. Like, it wasn't right. A New York Times topic the way it is now.
There weren't moms creating psychedelic mom podcasts, right?
Right. The cultural attitudes were a lot different, and there's a lot of judgment around it. Even as I shared this story, I was pretty vocal about it with some of my spinal cord injury friends, and there was a lot of teasing from people who in the years since many of whom have their own regimens and protocols with psychedelic medicines now. Like, it seems like there's been a large shift from Michael Pollan's books and from the continuing research data sets that...
Yeah, I'm going back when I first got into this field, I couldn't talk about it. So look at the shift of like not even being able to talk about it, not even being able to talk about it with my family.
Yeah.
My kids, and then to today. You know, that's a massive shift in a very short period of time, really, like a 5-year period.
It's been really rapid, huh?
So in this exploration of whether psychedelics belong in our kitchens, doctor's offices, maybe even religious ceremonies, what did you come to know about psychedelics after this experience? Did you continue working with them? Were people who were doing research asking you to come allow them to kind of do some studies with you? What happened from there?
From there, I feel like it was kind of my own initiative of like kind of probing and poking at this question in different ways. Like, it seemed, at least anecdotally, pretty clear that this mushroom experience had allowed this motor function to resume working. It seemed like that was at least a somewhat moderately common story among other people with similar injuries who had also experimented with drug use. And that led to a lot of reading. It led to more self-experimentation. It led to a lot of conversations. It's only been very recently that the academic and medical side has shown any interest in spinal cord injuries and the possible uses for psychedelics in their treatment. Anecdotally, it seems like there's some reason to think that there's, like, again, not a magic solution and maybe not going to work for everyone, but at least some potential to be another lever that someone can pull to help to further their recovery. But my suspicion is that's probably going to look like it's still going to take a huge volume of exercise-based therapy in conjunction with these medicines, and that maybe there's some 5 or 8 or 12% difference in the speed of somebody's recovery or the extent of somebody's recovery in conjunction with these substances versus just doing the effort, the physical therapy alone.
Well, that's kind of an interesting parallel, because in psychedelic therapy, you know, psychedelics aren't a magic pill in the sense that you don't take, although it is called a magic mushroom, then there's much magic to it. When you are working with someone with trauma or PTSD, or even someone who wants to experience these medicines for a spiritual awakening, it's not like one pill changes everything. You kind of still have to do the work of peeling back the layers of self. And so it sounds similar in its physical potentials, that it helped an aspect, but you still and people with injuries still have to do the physical recovery. So I'm just making that parallel, like when people go to ayahuasca ceremonies or different medicine ceremonies to learn aspects of themselves, it gets revealed, but what you do with it is also part of your life path. And it sounds kind of like similar. It wasn't a magic pill, but it was, yeah, if you had to put words to it, what was it for you? What was magic mushrooms in your healing process?
It feels like it's been a bit of a gateway, that experience. Like it's led, I have a lot more interest in like ceremonial use and intentional use and medicinal use. I haven't used them in the same recreational way. I kind of shifted my relationship to them. It's led to some interesting forms of community about meeting people with similar interests and similar wavelengths and finding connection there.
What would you say to somebody who is kind of still in that place of thinking these are just drugs? Once you kind of shifted in a way to have more experiences with psychedelics and earth medicines in a ceremonial way, what did you learn from that? Like, what would you say to somebody was some of the things that you learned about yourself and actually about the wisdom of these medicines? How would you categorize them and describe them and talk about what they've brought to your life?
One of the ways they seem really useful to me is the ability to kind of to zoom out on myself, where I can get so entrenched in like the patterns of the ways that I see things, and maybe particularly the patterns of the ways that I see myself, because some of those tend to be so much of a default setting, so much of a baseline that it's hard to imagine that there's any other option.
Could you give an example?
Yeah, well, I think one point of view that's something that we touched on earlier in this interview was kind of this sense of my individual being something that's made up of a lot of other things that are almost like their own individual beings, their own individual components. Like there's a sciencey perspective where I have about as many microbiome cells in my body as I do actual human cells in my body, and that there are just trillions and trillions of organisms on me and in me that influence the way that I interact and perceive the world, that are, among other things, producing almost all the serotonin that my body has. It isn't being produced by my body, it's being produced by things that are living in my body. And so there's this collaborative effort that forms me. And then also maybe I have a place almost like a cell within a larger organism along inside this human society, inside this Gaia creature that maybe we're all a part of. Mm-hmm. And so I really appreciate that framing of seeing myself as being embedded within a much larger system and being composed of in a tremendous amount of these little teeny systems.
Mm-hmm. We are intricately woven. And when you think of our body is really a system of an interbeing.
Absolutely. I think that's like, it's one thing to kind of intellectualize it in this sciencey way that, you know, of universe scale to molecular and cellular scale. There's a spiritual aspect of it that's, you know, something like Eastern religion, non-duality. Mm-hmm. And both of those, at least for me, can be like a really cerebral. Mm-hmm. And like, it's one thing to have it as an idea. It's a whole other thing to have a felt experience of that. And I think psychedelics are a bit of a shortcut, it seems like.
Yeah.
Like maybe it doesn't take 10,000 hours on a meditation cushion to feel that, to have a really visceral felt sense that maybe there's some advantages to potentially to getting there through the 10,000 hours on the meditation cushion. Maybe it's something you can stick with that for a long time because you've spent so much time in preparation versus being tossed into it with more immediacy from a psychedelic experience where coming back from that, it's like the integration piece is really hard. There's some bringing that back and being like, what does this mean for my daily life? How do I continue to hold this point of view and not have it fade in the same way that weird or wonderful dream that I had while sleeping last night, you know, is like with me for a few minutes. And then by lunchtime, it's hard to even remember. Mm-hmm. I think psychedelics, like they take some effort in a different way, but there is some real potential to experience that sense of interbeing in a way that's maybe hard for a lot of us to access on our own.
I think too that all that you're describing, the difference between the cognitive lens, the spiritual lens, and then this experiential lens. And I almost think like in that experiential lens, in my own experience, and is there's something about this knowing, like this word knowing comes into mind where when you're in the experience and even when you leave that experience, it's kind of like a deep knowing that it is true, that there is some truth in what just happened, in what you just experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're just hinting at the integration piece of how do we embody that wisdom and bring it back to our lives. Like, you know, what would you say is like the nugget that you've tried to embody in your day-to-day life?
I mean, all the things that seem like they're the most true all sound like a Hallmark card greeting, right? Like there's just, it's things like the importance of love and the importance of service and the importance of giving back. I don't think you need a psychedelic to realize the importance of that. And also there's like a profundity to it. It's just like, I don't know, there's a reason the word ineffable gets thrown around so much in conversations about psychedelics, because some of it just really, really defies being put eloquently into words. That part of knowing, the gnosis part, is like, if it was easily communicated through words, then it wouldn't be such a rare experience.
So do you see yourself as somebody who would be in some form of psychedelic space? You know, is that a path for you of working with people with injury? And is that something that you've considered?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that'd be a fascinating thing to be involved in. I would love that. And also, I think there's some cautionary pieces that are maybe unique to disabled community. One of the most evident ones is that these substances, these medicines interact with the same nerve, the same serotonin receptors that cause muscle spasticity. And so it's really, really common for people with spinal cord injuries to have muscle spasms that can kind of look either just like involuntary muscle rigidity, or can look more like just like a bad Charlie horse, or a lot of like a shaking kind of a spasm. It's kind of seizure looking. And if you imagine somebody who's maybe psychedelically naive and disabled, and then using these medicines and then having 3 hours of intense spasms.
Have you ever experienced that?
Yeah, I think, I have muscle spasms.
Is there a psychedelic that happens more with versus another psychedelic, or is dosing involved, or is it somewhat unpredictable?
I think there's probably like more research is needed, like anecdotally talking to mm-hmm. friends and from my personal experiences, it does seem like dosing is a big factor. Some people with spinal cord injuries are just more prone to that spasticity. Some people don't experience it at all. Some people who don't normally experience it at all then do have it during a psychedelic experience. It seems like an area that people in entering this would want to have some caution. And if someone at home was thinking about exploring this on their own, that I think it would probably be wise to start really small, like start with a microdose and then work up to a half gram psilocybin dose and then to a 1 gram dose over a series of weeks or months and individual experiences, which is probably good advice for just about anyone.
Would you recommend somebody not be alone?
That seems like having a trip sitter, a caretaker, somebody who's there to help out seems like it'd be a great idea, having a facilitator. Like, I think there's just maybe not enough data for me to, I think there's a lot of potential there. And it just seems like that is like spasms along with some potential other, body dysregulation that can happen with people whose nervous systems just work differently from an able-bodied person.
Now, just being in this space, I'm just curious, because have you come across anybody specializing in holding space in this area?
I have not, no.
Interesting.
No, I've volunteered myself for a bit of it, but no, I think it's maybe just too new of a subset of an already somewhat obscure
mm-hmm.
area of interest.
So for you now, where you are physically, let's start with the physical, where is your recovery?
I walk with a pretty significant limp, mm-hmm. But for somebody who spent half a year in a wheelchair, I really have had a tremendous recovery. I used to ski a lot. I ski some now, but I'm pretty mediocre. I ride bicycles a lot. I really like mountain biking. I really like commuting to work on my bike. I think bikes kind of help to allow me to compensate for some of the way my disability presents. Like my balance is pretty poor. I just don't have the strength or endurance or quickness or agility or ability to high step that I used to. Like it's, and having said that, I am able to live independently and have a lot of agency for like day-to-day life chores.
And your work is as an artist and a photographer?
As an artist, I don't do photography work anymore. I do some communication strategy and I work at a gym called Ripple Effect, where it tends to be, it's like a gym for people who don't like gyms. It's a mountain athlete training center is actually what it doesn't call itself a gym. Everyone has four or five outdoor sports and people are often coming there for months at a time as they recuperate from an injury, or as they are entering middle age and wanting to keep doing their 20-mile trail runs and all and not and keep their body fit so that they can continue to do these all these outdoor things. That's most of the clientele there.
And so what is your art now without if you've moved away from photography, what is your new form of art?
I like making woodcut prints, which are
Oh, beautiful.
an elaborate stamp, like a rubber stamp but carved into wood.
So you have a website called
Yes,
perpetualweekend.com.
that's right.
What is that website all about?
That website is like my photo portfolio that really hasn't been updated now in 8 years. Maybe about a dozen years ago, I had been interested in branding myself as a photographer. At the time, it was a little bit of a weird move to brand myself as like my photography business as something other than my given name. And so I ended up with Perpetual Weekend that was felt to me like an aspirational goal, like we were speaking about earlier, of kind of adhering to this path of wanting to do work that felt meaningful, and like how can I get paid to do things that I enjoy doing, felt like the goal and felt like the ethos behind that name. And then at some point, post spine injury, life didn't feel like as much of a perpetual weekend, and started an art website that's gorgeousstorm.com.
Oh,
So
beautiful.
that felt like it was a little more reflective of the kind of the internal state of
The gorgeous storm.
the struggle and the friction, and also kind of the beauty in the process of it.
Do you look at your life? I'm thinking of that title, The Gorgeous Storm. And when you look back and even where you are today, do you look at kind of your life as a hero's journey from in one that's continuing.
Yeah, I think it's easy to map some Joe Campbell ideas onto my life, or
Yeah,
map my life
exactly.
onto some Joe Campbell ideas, really. There's this YouTube clip of Kurt Vonnegut talking about The Shape of Stories. He has this lecture where he's talking about all the diagramming rising and falling action. And one of them, he's quipped something about, he's like, this one we call man in a hole. Like, man's doing pretty well. Man falls in a hole. Man climbs out of hole. People love this one. And that really resonates. And I think like I can zoom out on myself and appreciate the life arc that I've lived for how it maps to that and why it's like, yeah, that's a pretty good story.
And are there certain people, if someone else goes through what you've gone through, whether it's physical or whether it is that fall in the hole, what would you say were some of those touch points of wisdom? Or was there, like a Joseph Campbell, was there someone you really, what was kind of your landing pad, your roots?
So one of the books, two books I actually read at the same time that really landed for me were one is called Flow, the Psychology of Optimum Experience by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who's like a Hungarian-American psychologist. And then another is, it's an Eckhart Tolle book, The Power of Now. Yeah, Power of Now. Which is like the kind of westernized version of Eastern spirituality's take on presence and mindfulness and flow state, versus this like 1992 kind of pop science treatise on this idea of flow state of, you know, taps back into just circling back to earlier in our conversation, those, that immediate feedback of like tangible consequences that we find out in nature are something that's a key ingredient for flow state. Like in Mihai Csikszentmihalyi's three criteria, I think were that you needed to have some prior experience in the thing that you were doing. There needed to be some clear goals, and there needed to be immediate feedback. And anytime those three criteria are met, it can be washing the dishes, it can be skiing, it can be professional work, but you can have this really, you can have this really enchanted state of deep focus that comes about when those criteria are met, where time just flows, flies by, and our sense of self changes, and we operate at peak performance. And I think that's something that in reading that book, I recognized how I've oriented a lot of my life to kind of seek those experiences and to cultivate that in some certain ways. It felt like after a spinal cord injury that some of those ways that I had gotten good at accessing that were no longer very accessible to me. Mm-hmm. And that book was so helpful, and Eckhart Tolle's book, because they point to ways that they can be accessible in a whole lot of other ways, that ways that I hadn't considered. And so I think that was some of the growth that happened for me, and some of the kind of the landing that I found was like, oh, this isn't gone forever. I just need to find new interests and new ways to access this.
And what would you say one of those ways is? Is it through art and at this point, like meditation? And
well, it's like some of the things that kind of came really naturally to me are all really high sensory activities, like mm-hmm. skiing and mountain biking and things where there's speed and adventure and novelty and the sense of perceived risk that all are really good at in training our attention and really drawing all of our focus. And it's harder for me to do that in like lower sensory environments where things like meditation. So that's been a mm-hmm. been a practice for me most days the last 5 years, 6 years of trying to sit and be still and find some of that same immediacy and presence in situations that where I'm not being forced into it, where I'm gently steering myself into it.
If you thought like where you want to be in 5 years, any ideas?
I mean, I would love to find a way to work more with the disabled community, the adaptive community. It'd be really interesting to see how the culture shifts here in Colorado now that we've just passed a Natural Medicines Health Act that legalizes therapeutic act and decriminalizes personal use of these medicines. That'll be really interesting to see where that leads. I think that's some big question marks.
It's interesting because you had like, in some ways, mm-hmm. the interest in biology. Mm-hmm. The connection already to Mother Earth through all your activities out in nature. And then this accident, which now brings you to this place of deep service in giving back. You know, they always talk about when your trauma becomes your dharma, mm-hmm. you know, and the idea that you're talking about of what does it look like to live in Colorado? Is there a path where you're supporting others in this way? I'll be interested to see.
Yeah, it's not an idea that I'm holding to super tightly, but it's also something that I would love if life carries me that direction.
Well, thank you so much for today. It's been a gift to get to know you, to hear your story, to learn about you and this process that you're in. And I really look forward to actually following your path where you go from here. Is there anything that you would want able-bodied people to know about that experience before we go? Like, what are some of the things that as able-bodied we could be more conscious of?
Feels like a missed opportunity to say, I don't know, but able-bodied people intersecting with disabled community in particular, I think it takes a while. It takes some practice sometimes to see people as fully human when they are really different from the way we perceived ourselves. Mm-hmm. And you can see degrees of that even with people who have traveled globally versus people who maybe haven't had the opportunity to see the world or to spend time in other really different cultures. It's so easy to see people as other. And being part of the disabled community, it's so easy to see everyone as fully human, and also kind of possible to remember back to a time where I think I did see probably those people in wheelchairs and people with visible disabilities as being an other.
It probably goes back to what you were talking about before, mm-hmm. the interbeingness, that we're not separate, to see each other as one and to look past all of the things that condition us to think of labels.
Yeah, I think it just takes some life experience and practice for a lot of us to move out of our basic self-centeredness, self-focusedness that seems to be like the default for being human. Mm-hmm. And so I wish everyone well on that journey for the way that looks for each of us.
Yeah. We're all on it. Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, no, thanks for your time today. Thanks for the kind and curious and thoughtful questions.
Beautiful.
If you enjoyed today's show and want to help build a more beautiful, conscious, and loving world, please share this content with friends, family, and colleagues. You can follow this show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use, and I'd really appreciate you taking the time to write a review so that others can find these amazing conversations. And if you'd like to see a video version of the show, you can find me on YouTube. Feel free to reach out and connect with me at thepsychedelicmom.com or message me on Instagram at @thepsychedelicmom. And remember, you are the medicine.